Jack Rice is absolutely the best defense attorney in Minneapolis, St. Paul right now. He's kind enough today to join us to talk about a busy legal news day. Jack, thank you very much. I appreciate the time, my friend.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
First of all, I want to give you credit. I saw this up on your Facebook feed. You got a nice little award yesterday, the Minnesota Lawyer Award Ceremony. You were named one of the Minnesota Attorneys of the Year. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I was pretty thrilled with my co-counsel, Willow Najar Anderson. We represented the man on the Christopher Columbus statue.
Mm-hmm.
And that case was a huge deal for us because not just did we get that case dismissed, the felony charges were dismissed. In the end, this Native American man really talking about this issue, the government actually acknowledged historical and current day harm to the Native community on the record, which is a massive move for the state of Minnesota and really for the Native American community. Massive deal for us. Thank you for letting me sort of ring my own bell, but really my co-counsel who just killed it in this case. So thank you.
You both are fantastic. And this is one of the reasons why I tell you Jack Rice is the best defense attorney in Minneapolis, St. Paul, hands down. Jack Rice defense is at jackricelaw.com. Now, the Potter trial. Your thoughts. 2 years. She's out in 16 months with good behavior. That's the sentence handed down today by the judge against Kim Potter. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's brutal, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's brutal for a lot of reasons. First of all, what we know about Kim Potter was this. She was convicted of manslaughter one, manslaughter two. The sentencing guidelines in a case like this, based upon no criminal record, is 86 months for the manslaughter one, 48 months for the manslaughter two. And that's based upon no criminal record and sort of an average case, if you will. Originally, the state said they were going to go for a double upward departure, saying because of her position of authority, we want it to be even worse. In this particular case, they then pulled back a couple of days ago. So the expectation was somewhere in that range, 86 months for the bigger one, for the lesser count, 48 months. The judge came back with 24 months with good timing. She has 58 days of custody credit. In 14 months and 2 days, she's out.
The thing which is crazy is Dante Wright is dead. And this entire notion, we had a trial. The jury found her guilty on both counts. The entire notion of what the judge just did here dismissed the seriousness of the offense. It dismissed the seriousness of the convictions. And she just went on her own there. She was crying. She was talking about, we got to be compassionate. You know, I highly doubt if this was a black person in your courtroom under the same circumstances, she would have offered 24 months at all. But at the same time, what do you think was going through her head at that time?
You know, it's interesting because I had a murder case in front of Judge Chu. Regina Chu is a Hennepin County judge. And I think what she's trying to do, and I can never speak for anybody, but this is my thought, is that what she's trying to do is to balance two interests at the same time. There is the interest to the right thing and trying to figure out how do you acknowledge to them the seriousness of the charges and the extraordinary loss to having to bury your own child. And let's face it, there may be nothing worse than that for anybody on the planet. On the one side, versus the other side, which says that Kim Potter did this by mistake and that this was an accident. And that her mistake cost this boy his life. At the same time, and I think this is part of the process, is that if you watch the video, she is on the ground not long after this happens, weeping, and another officer has to reach in and take her weapon from her out of fear of what she might do. You combine those two side by side, and I think she's trying to thread the needle in this case in which there are some people on the other side of this saying she shouldn't have done a day. So think about that. You got the people saying nothing. You have the other people saying 8 years, that's not enough. This would have been far worse if this were a black man who were a cop.
Brought up Wright's family. They are furious, and understandably so. The official statements being released talk about how disappointed they are that this was so light, that they regret the fact that they went in there and they put all their emotions on paper to try to read his statements here, asking for justice. They are clearly very disappointed in the judge's ruling. So if she was trying to thread a needle, she did a pretty horrible job of it.
Yeah, I think they are very, very angry. Mr. Crump, who is the civil attorney in this case, Also, he's been a civil attorney in a lot of very high-profile cases, including the Ahmaud Arbery case, and multiple others. We have seen him multiple times. They were trying to clarify exactly what this means. I can tell you, it's interesting because from a defense perspective, and again, I'm a former prosecutor as a criminal defense attorney. What I thought of is there are times when you take cases to trial, regardless of how bad the facts are, if the offer in the case is so one-sided or so terrible. And one of the problems that I think that the prosecution had in this case was that there was so much pressure on them that they probably made no offer whatsoever. And so a lot of reasons that cases negotiate to plea, and it's usually like 98%, it's an extraordinarily high number, is out of fear that if you don't do that, the system will be overwhelmed. And in this case, the politics behind this, which was, who's going to let this woman simply walk? And so as a result, the offer was probably no offer at all, plead guilty, and with nothing else. There have been times in cases where the facts are sketchy at best. And what happens is if your client is found guilty, and this is my thought process, sort of big picture, if your client is found guilty, there are times when I have been able to get better sentences than I was offered, even if I went to trial and lost. Mm-hmm. And so I think the defense was thinking about this issue and gambling what that would mean rather than simply plead and hope things would play out. And it did. For her case.
And I was watching the defense argument. I was at the Y and I was running, and I was watching their argument, and this is kind of how it went with me. Her lawyer was out there saying, well, she was on the honor guard for an officer that was murdered. Well, that's nice of her, but she murdered Dante Wright. Oh, here are all these letters to talk about how great she is. That's very nice, but she murdered Dante Wright. I kept saying to myself that when she shot him, you brought it up. She didn't go run to the car to try to save him. She didn't try to give any life. She basically fell down and was so emotional about her own circumstance that she didn't offer any aid or assistance to the man she just shot through the heart, accidentally. And I said, I understand accidents, and we've talked about this. You and I have talked about this. It was an accident, but there are consequences for accident. There is, involuntary manslaughter. There, vehicular homicide, where a person didn't mean to hit a car, but they did. You know, we do hold people accountable for accidents, and here in this case, all they've done is reestablish the idea that if you're a cop, there's a different legal standard that you basically will not be held accountable like the rest of us, even when you have such an egregious accident as you killed somebody.
Oh, I think it's actually worse than that. I think there are a lot of people who are arguing something even deeper than that. And that's that if you're an officer and you kill a white person, you're going to pay a price for that. If you kill a black person, the price is simply not as high. And I think that is the argument. Mm-hmm. I think the argument and the fear is that what this does is this supports this schism that's happening in America. I mean, if we think about where we are, and you and I have talked about this, I've taught trial advocacy to prosecutors and defense attorneys all over the world and the United States. I just did for the National Institute of Trial Advocacy yesterday. And what happens is that if you have a criminal justice system that does not apply equally across the country, and in other words, people who are white get a certain system and people who are black get a different system, it's the very bedrock of what like mends a society and makes that society whole. And when you have a swath of society who says this system is gamed against us, that is what is ripping society to pieces. Yes, I understand the Donald Trumps of the world and others, one way or the other, where you are politically, that's one thing. But when you have a system that applies different standards to different people based upon what they look like, that is what tears society to bits. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think a lot of people are really, really desperately concerned about in a case like this when you look at the outcomes as compared to other outcomes across the country and even here in Minnesota.
Jack Rice joining us, jackricedefense.com. We have the other major trial going in there, and it'll be interesting to actually get your thoughts on how this sentence is going to possibly affect that trial. The trial of the other three officers in the George Floyd murder, they went on the stand, and you and I talked about that the last time you were on the air about, you know, kind of pointing the fingers at other people. Although King didn't, I wasn't really impressed with him. I don't know where he thought he was going, but this whole idea, I didn't notice that he was in medical problems. You didn't? Well, then you're a bad cop, because he was clearly having a lot of problems there.
Well, isn't it interesting? I think the real issue, and it was interesting because in the last few days, I've actually had some conversations with a lot of the inside players. And what I can tell you is, I think there were some very conscious decisions where these officers felt compelled to take the stand in their own defense because they had to. If they didn't do it in this case, they would simply be crucified as a result. The video was so horrifying. And yet at the same time, I think what I'm also hearing, and this is sort of inside now, what I'm hearing is that there's a lot of people saying that the prosecution, their prosecution is falling flat. It's not going very, very well in this case. And so this was a gamble on the behalf of the defense to say, if the prosecution isn't working and we can humanize those charged, and that's really one of the reasons you put somebody on the stand is so the jury can see what they say and then judge them based upon that, that what's going on is this was a calculated risk by King, Tao, and Lane to humanize themselves and to say it wasn't me. So Lane is saying, I told them they should turn him over. I'm the one who called the paramedics. I'm the one who tried to help revive him. We have Tao who's saying, I'm doing crowd control. I assume the 19-year officer who's on top of him knows what he's doing, and I'm looking this direction, not that. I'm doing the best that I can with what I've got. And then we have King on the other side of this saying, you know, we're not the ones who's running this show. It's the 19-year veteran, and we're doing the best we can, thinking that he knows what he's doing, so we defer. That's the argument that you're going to make. The question is, and this is the bottom line, do you have a jury who is predisposed to buy that argument and to accept what officers say? Because I can tell you, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when I first started trying cases, I saw where jurors would hook, line, and sinker by what police officers say. It's a different world now.
One of the things from the last time when they were talking about King's testimony that King lacked the training and experience to recognize Mr. Chauvin's excessive use of force. That was kind of the argument that they were trying to make. It is you and I have talked about this. I mean, and it'd be interesting to see if Chauvin would have done this, what would have been the outcome there? You throw the Minneapolis police force under the bus itself. You know, obviously they're pointing at Chauvin and saying, well, he was the guy that did it. And, right. You know, how are we the young rookie to go over there and put him, you know, and pull him off from what he's doing. So, I mean, it is going to be interesting because I think that you and I have both said that this actually is not the worst defense to point and blame the clearly systemic problems with the Minneapolis Police Department, and the officers themselves can fall back on and say, yeah, they do have problems because they're not going to go back to work there. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, it's pretty disgusting for a lot of reasons. And this was the conversation you and I have had for some time now. And this is what we have seen as a defense from police departments over and over and over again across the country, including in Minneapolis. When something terrible happens, they point at these officers and they say, one bad apple. Every single time. And they always blame this guy. And it's always guys, usually. I mean, except for Kim Potter, but almost always. And they say, this one cop is a bad cop. But what we have seen over and over with the city of Minneapolis is that they have a plethora, there's a big word,
yes,
a plethora of bad cops. And when you start having not just one, not just two, but three and four and five and on, and this lawsuit and that lawsuit and the other lawsuit and the excessive use of force and this and that, you start realizing that it's not just the ones and twos. It's systemic, that what you have is a failure to train these officers, to continue to train these officers, to retain officers who should never have been retained. And then you put them in positions of leadership, and you wonder why we're paying out $20 million at a time.
Yeah.
And we are. I mean, that's a legitimate question. And actually, I would argue it's a legitimate defense if you turn around and say, I'm a cop who's been on the beat for 4 days. And if my training was substandard, and my leadership is incompetent, and the people who are on the beat with me don't know what they're doing, and I'm there 4 days, do you hold me responsible at a level that you should a 19-year veteran?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah. And I think that can grab a jury. It can.
By the way, your argument is also beautiful, and the argument of how do you challenge all these Republicans on these pro-cop bills that they're putting through. Say, why not the first thing saying the Minneapolis taxpayers are no longer on the hook, that the state will cover all these settlements that these police, because of this bad policing, that the taxpayers of Minneapolis have to pay, that the state will cover that. I guarantee you, you will see a lot of Republicans pucker up real quick.
Yeah. Well, you know, I tell you what. When it becomes a financial question, all of a sudden it changes, right? I mean, what's really interesting is this idea of looking at criminal justice reform. This is one of those rare circumstances where all of a sudden you saw liberals, Democrats, and some conservative Republicans come together. And the reason these conservative Republicans came together is because they started looking at it and realizing when you start putting people in prisons forever for sometimes really goofy stuff, the cost is extraordinary, and they're tired of paying it. It's not about justice, was it ever? Is it about something else? And in this case, it's about the almighty dollar. And you put that as sacrosanct above everything else. And, well, it makes it an interesting set of arguments for some strange bedfellows.
One last thing, because this guarantees you and I are going to be talking on a regular basis for a while again here. The latest story, the Minneapolis Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the FBI are investigating the Stallings incident, the tape there, not only for what happened with the police officers, but, I mean, there were two people that after the police had them subdued, the police proceeded to beat the living daylights out of them and clearly violating their rights. The Minneapolis Police Department hasn't done a damn thing about this in almost 2 years after that incident happened. But now the FBI, I think the reason why Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is jumping on it is because the FBI is jumping on it and they don't want to look like they dropped the ball themselves. But clearly there are going to be some people looking into this saying, what the heck did you do to these people again?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if we realize it, one of the things that happened after George Floyd is the Bureau is here right now and they're looking at the Minneapolis Police Department, and they should. Because there is a history of this. This goes back decades. Certainly in the last 10 or 20 years, you can look at this behavior, the training, the retention, and the number of payouts, the number of excessive force complaints, and the oversight that comes with that. I'm not saying every cop is a bad cop. They aren't. In fact, every time you keep a bad cop, what it does is it drives the good ones out.
Yep.
It's my dear friends are cops. And I sit across from them, and they're just like, they got their head in their hand. Because it's like, look, I'm doing everything I know how to do. And there's idiots out there who makes my life impossible. And so I think if you're going to be pro-cop here, and I think if we have good cops, we should all be pro-good cop. How's that? Mm-hmm. Let's start with that. Can we accept that?
100%. I know two police officers in the suburbs off the record. I'm not going to say which suburbs even, but they've told me they used to work in Minneapolis. They left that police force because that place was a nut house over there, and that they went out to the suburbs because they said at least out here there's some common sense and rationality of what they're doing as opposed to the you know, kind of the, you know, what's going on in Minneapolis. And so, yeah, I mean, they're going to have to clean that up. And once again, I've said this ever since that ballot initiative failed in November. If you guys don't clear it up, there's going to be another ballot initiative, and one of them eventually will pass.
Yeah, well, they'll do that. But what you're also going to see is you're going to see the feds come in and take control of the department.
Yep.
And if that happens, it's going to get weird. And it does get weird because you have no choice. And what does that say? What does it say when frequently we see people up in the Midwest and in the Northeast looking down south saying, look what those people are doing. Look at those departments and how they do these terrible things to people. And all of a sudden you turn around and say, we can't actually reform when we know we've got a problem because we've decided what? It's not convenient for us. And we just sort of wait till the next can gets kicked down the road. So we start with Floyd the latest Floyd. We had Noor before that. We can go before Noor, but now we can talk about Amir Locke. We can talk about no-knock search warrants. And it's almost as if we're holding our breath now, waiting for the next case to drop.
We are. God, it's just...
Aren't we? Look, I just got off of TV on this thing, and that's exactly the problem, right? Is you realize it's sort of one after the other, and you get these fine threads that you continue to weave into a thicker and thicker rope, and you start wondering at what point are we just destroying ourselves as we do nothing and say, no, this one's not a problem. How about the next one? Well, what about the one after that? At some point, we have to ask ourselves and really address it.
Absolutely. JackRiceLaw.com. JackRiceLaw.com. That's the website for Jack Rice Defense, award-winning defense attorney. And once again, if you've got a question, you got a case, you want to ask him, get some honest feedback, Jack is the person to talk to. Jack Rice Defense at JackRiceLaw.com. Jack, outstanding as always. Thank you very much. I imagine we'll be talking to you before too much longer.
Well, I'm thrilled. Thank you so much. Great to be with you, as always.
A pleasure, as always, my friend. Jack Rice, kind enough to join us today. Let's take a break, come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.